John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, June the 29th, 2011. A ship known as the Giuliano, after assassinated activist Giuliano Merchamis, has been sabotaged on Monday evening as it was being prepared for departure on the Freedom Flotilla 2, which contains 10 boats and approximately 500 activists who are sailing to Gaza this week. British authorities arrested late on Tuesday night Sheikh Raed Salah, head of the northern branch of the Islamic movement in Israel, under the claim that he poses a threat to public security in Britain. On Sunday, Sheikh Salah had no problem with British security when he landed at Heathrow Airport. Recently, the British Home Office decided that Sheikh Raed Salah should not be allowed into the country. No specific reason was given for this. On Saturday, British Home Secretary Theresa May issued an official injunction to ban Sheikh Raed Salah from entering the country, according to Israel's Ynet News. He was originally invited to deliver a speech to the Palestine Solidarity Campaign in front of British parliamentarians of the opposition Labour Party. Palestinian Authority Prime Minister Salam Fayyad has said that a recognition of Palestinian statehood in September will not change facts on the ground in terms of Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The decentralized hacker group Anonymous have declared that their next target will be the Israeli Knesset. The group, which are an anonymous collection of decentralized internet hackers, have announced July the 28th as their date for their planned attack on the Israeli Knesset website, which is codenamed Operation Intifada. A committee of the Israeli Knesset passed the first draft of a law that will require Palestinians whose homes are demolished by Israeli forces to pay the Israeli government for the demolition costs. The law will now be passed to the full Knesset for a final reading, where it is expected to pass. Since 1967, Israeli forces have demolished 24,813 Palestinian homes. In the first 5 months of 2011, Israeli forces demolished more Palestinian homes than in the entire year of 2010, rendering homeless 706 Palestinians, including 341 minors. This is according to the most recent figures released by the Israeli Civil Administration. If the law is passed by the full Knesset, any Palestinian whose home is destroyed by the Israeli military will have to pay thousands of dollars to cover the cost of the demolition. Already, many Palestinian homeowners, mainly in Jerusalem, have been forced to pay for the demolition of their homes. House demolitions in unoccupied territory are illegal under Article 53 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, unless rendered unavoidable by absolute military necessity. The first of the Freedom Flotilla II ships have set sail for the rendezvous point in the Mediterranean Sea, where they will meet the rest of the ships participating in the flotilla. This is according to Haaretz newspaper. It is unclear when they will meet up with the other participating ships, including the US, Canadian and Greek, Norwegian, Swedish contingent, given bureaucratic delays and suspected sabotage of the Greek ship. After ignoring police summons, Rabbi Yaakov Yusuf faces arrest for a written endorsement of Torat Hamelech, which justifies the killing of non-Jews, including babies, that pose a threat to the nation of Israel. Commentary states that the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," only applies to a Jew killing another Jew. On Monday, police detained the rabbi briefly for questioning. Right-wing activists were photographed carrying the rabbi after his release from the brief detention with Israeli police. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef is head of the Hazon Yaakov Yeshiva and served as a member of the Knesset for the Shas political party from 1984 to 1988, and he continues to be investigated for his endorsement of the Torah Amalek. Five structures and two tents were raised in the illegal settlement outpost of Ramat Migro in the northern West Bank on Wednesday morning even. Two teenage girls were arrested for allegedly throwing a paint bottle at police during clashes between the Israeli military and the settlers. According to Ynet, Israeli military policy in the past year has been to not demolish permanent structures, even those judged illegal under Israeli law, but only to demolish impermanent West Bank settlement outposts. That's all for today from the IMEMC. This was Wednesday the 29th of June's daily roundup of news from the occupied Palestinian territories. We hope you will join us again tomorrow. This report has been brought to you by Hussam Qazis and me, David Steele.
Extra, extra, extra. This week, a number of DC activists will be sailing for Gaza as part of Freedom Flotilla 2, a flotilla of aid ships challenging Israel's blockade of occupied Gaza. We can't forget what happened to one of the aid ships last year when Israeli commandos boarded the ship using automatic weapons and a number of activists were killed. That means our activists, people from here in D.C., many whose activities are covered right here on this radio station, are sailing into harm's way, putting their bodies on the line for the people of occupied Gaza. Sunday, the U.S. military has announced that two U.S. soldiers were killed while conducting operations in an undisclosed location in northern Iraq on Sunday, the 26th of June. That makes June the deadliest month in 2 years for U.S. soldiers in Iraq. Afghanistan, yesterday, NATO is reporting the deaths of two soldiers of unspecified nationality from insurgent attacks in southern Afghanistan on Tuesday. Afghanistan, Monday. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unspecified nationality from an IED blast in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, over the weekend, NATO forces announced the deaths of at least seven soldiers in a variety of incidents. One more died in a hospital of wounds received June 15th, and one more died of non-combat wounds. Was this yet another GI suicide? Kabul, Afghanistan, yesterday. Eight armed suicide fighters stormed the International Hotel in downtown Kabul. At least 19 people were killed, including the eight attackers. The hotel is popular with international guests, meaning foreigners, which in this case probably means agents of NATO's occupation. The 11 people other than the attackers killed included a judge from an unnamed province, five hotel workers, and three Afghan policemen, according to Lutfullah Marshall, the spokesman for the Afghan National Directorate for Security. He said no foreigners were killed, but two foreigners were among 14 people wounded in the attack. He did not disclose their nationalities. The attack followed the time-honored Taliban pattern where suicide bombers serve as artillery to soften up the target, followed by infantry armed with automatic weapons and also wearing bomb vests for when they get overwhelmed. As the attack began, a suicide bomber detonated on the second floor. Three fighters reached the roof, and there was a report that a rocket-propelled grenade was fired from there at the vice president's house. After hours of battle, the three fighters on the roof were killed when two helicopter gunships opened fire with rockets. It is exceedingly rare for anyone to call in a helicopter gunship attack on a ritzy upper-class hotel, even if insurgents are inside. The Taliban took credit for this attack, though the rockets presumably did as much damage to the hotel as anything else. Video footage from the attack showed fire on the roof, presumably from the rockets. Afghanistan, Sunday, an 8-year-old girl was killed, reportedly while trying to set up a bomb. Afghanistan, Saturday, an SUV bomb blew up outside a clinic in eastern Afghanistan on Saturday. It was at first thought to have killed at least 60 people, wounded at least 120, and it leveled the 10-bed medical center. The next day, the official death toll was reported as 38, with the Taliban denying all responsibility for the attack. Afghan officials are blaming the Haqqani network. Some say the hospital may not have been the intended target, as the bomb detonated when police tried to stop the bomber's car. Afghan-Pakistani border, since Saturday. At least 6 NATO fuel tank trucks, 1 fuel storage tank, and 2 NATO containers have been destroyed in the latest round of strategic attacks. Washington, ongoing. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates claims he has brought the war in Iraq to a successful conclusion. Only thing is, the U.S. has had no success in pacifying Iraq. The war is far from over. Iraq today. Two roadside bombs detonated in the city's southern district of Dura, one of them near Al-Rashid Vegetable Wholesale Market. A total of 9 civilians were wounded and 1 killed, and a number of buildings damaged. Tamaria, north of Baghdad, Iraq, Sunday. A suicide bombing at a police station killed 2 police officers and wounded either 10 or 18 people, according to one report. That same report says 3 people were killed, but then specifies only the 2 officers, perhaps including the attacker and the 3 deaths. AFP says 2 civilians, not police, were killed and 17 people injured, but at another point, the same story says 9 people were killed. Baghdad, Iraq, Saturday. Another roadside bomb went off near another convoy of U.S. military vehicles in Baghdad's western district of Adil. Wait a minute! What roadside bomb? What U.S. convoy? I thought combat operations in Iraq were over! Oh yeah, that's been said before. Mr. Barack Obama, haven't we had enough of all this? Now's the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home today.
In a nationally televised address on June 22nd, President Obama announced he would withdraw 10,000 U.S. troops from Afghanistan by the end of 2011. That represents one-third of the 33,000 additional soldiers he ordered deployed to Afghanistan in December 2009. Mr. Obama also told the nation that the remaining 23,000 surge troops would return to the U.S. by September 2012, with the remaining 70,000 to be withdrawn in 2014. With the Afghan war approaching its 10th anniversary this fall, America's longest war has lost significant public support. A May Quinnipiac opinion poll found that 60% of those surveyed believe the Afghan war is no longer worth fighting. In late 2009, the number was 44%. An unlikely alliance between anti-war congressional Democrats and anti-Obama Republicans has seen growing support for legislation that would accelerate the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and end the U.S. military role in Libya. Although the killing of terrorist leader Osama bin Laden during a U.S. raid of his compound in Pakistan is evidence, some say, of the weakening of al-Qaeda, several top Pentagon officials warn that a too rapid withdrawal could risk losing Afghanistan to the Taliban and al-Qaeda. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Anna Berlinroot, an organizer with the group Military Families Speak Out. Berlinroot's son, John, a Marine, has served one tour in Kosovo, three in Iraq, and is currently in Afghanistan. She criticizes President Obama's plan for a phased withdrawal of U.S. troops there as much too slow.
I was certainly not surprised at what he had said, but I think that he should be bringing all of the troops home within the year, not just his surged troops, but all of them should be back home. I know that it takes a long time just to pack up and to come home, and I think that the year from July, I think that that's a good time for all of them to be back.
Why do you think this deployment in Afghanistan should be cut short? What's your major reason for feeling this war has reached a dead end and then the United States should end its involvement?
Well, first, it is not making us any more secure. We're not safer by having our troops over there. Al-Qaeda has left Afghanistan. They've gone to Pakistan. They've gone to Yemen, Somalia, and several other places around the world. So being in Afghanistan is not going to really help us at all. And what are the basic objectives of the war at this point? There really are no objectives other than to try to make Afghanistan a bit more stable than it is today. And I don't think that we can do that. I don't think that we are going to be very successful in training the Afghan forces to come in and really take care of their own country. But that's up to them. It's not up to us.
Do you accept any part of the argument that so much blood and treasure has been spilled in Afghanistan that the president feels, and certainly there are those in the Pentagon who want even a slower withdrawal to ensure that the investment there, the gains they say they've made, won't be lost?
There's no way to really ensure that the gains will be lost. And what good is it to kill more of our troops? It looks to me like it's another Vietnam, where we were there for so many years, we lost over 58,000 troops, and the Pentagon Papers, which had just become public, told us that 70% of the reason that we were in Vietnam was to save face. And I'm afraid that that's pretty similar to why we're there in Afghanistan at this point.
And what's your feeling about reports we've seen gain credibility over the last few months that the United States and the Afghan government are now negotiating with the Taliban? Does that seem like a viable exit to your ears as you hear those reports?
Well, we probably cannot win militarily unless we were to bring in a tremendous number of troops. And we saw that even that did not win in Vietnam. So it will have to be some type of a political settlement. But of course it's very disturbing to see that the Taliban are in negotiations with us at this point, which means that they will be part of any future government. And therefore, why are we there losing more lives?
Anna Berlinroot, as you and the other members active in Military Families Speak Out consider President Obama's withdrawal plan from Afghanistan and your dissatisfaction with it, what are your plans for campaigning for a faster withdrawal? There have been some moves in Congress to propose bills that would speed up the withdrawal plan, even some idea that military funds should be cut off, again, in an effort to shorten the war. But what is your group working on right now?
Well, we are trying to meet with as many members of Congress as possible and to get the public more involved, and showing the alternatives as to how this money can be used, which we certainly need here. We need to nation build here. That's where our money should be going, and our troops should be here where they belong, not over there, where they are in harm's way every single day. Even if they were to leave as of tomorrow, just taking care of our wounded troops is going to be costing tremendous sums of money throughout the future. And this is something that I know from my family's experience. My dad lived well into his 80s, and he was a disabled World War II veteran. My grandfather was a disabled World War I era veteran, and it cost the government plenty of money just to take care of them throughout the rest of their lives.
That was Anna Berlinroot, an organizer with the group Military Families Speak Out. Learn more about the anti-war group by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
On the 22nd of June, protesters showed up in front of the White House demanding the closure of Guantanamo Bay and other torture centers such as the one at Bagram Air Base.
There it is. Justice delayed. Justice denied. That is the very symbol of the United States in today's age.
We're here in recognition of some sad and tragic facts. Guantanamo, despite the president's executive order on day one, remains open. Despite the promise of restoring the rule of law, there has been zero accountability or attempt to investigate or prosecute those who designed and carried out U.S. torture policies.
And so we defend those that disappear under hoods, into jumpsuits, bringing back into the light every CIA black site. Because right now there is a man under that hood. A brother breathing prayers of desperation, striking hunger so hard that his ribs are about to crack. In Afghanistan, in Guantanamo, in Iraq, there is a man under that hood who is being treated as less than human. His rights have been dismissed with the label terrorist, and just in saying this, you probably put my name on a list. But it is too serious to us to not resist.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming out today. My name's Tom Parker. I'm the Policy Director for Terrorism, Counterterrorism, and Human Rights at Amnesty International USA. And I've been asked to speak to you today about one of the cases that we're highlighting for Torture Awareness Month. And that is the case of a Canadian national, a Canadian telecommunications engineer called Maha Arar, who was detained by U.S. immigration authorities while transiting New York's JFK Airport on his way home to Canada from a family holiday. And he was plunged into a Kafkaesque nightmare of torture and abuse. In September 2002, he was traveling through JFK when he was pulled aside by U.S. officials. Canadian police had generated a deeply flawed intelligence report based on a brief social encounter in Ottawa between Maha Arar and a person of interest to the Canadian authorities. The U.S. accepted this report without question, and Arar's nightmare began. Despite his citizenship and his residency in Canada, Arar was handed over illegally to the Syrian government, a country whose human rights record the United States has routinely condemned. He was held for 374 days before he was finally released and turned home. This is how he described his ordeal. In Syria, I was put in a dark underground cell that was more like a grave. It was 3 feet wide and 6 feet deep and 7 feet high. Life in that cell was hell. I spent 10 months and 10 days in that grave. During the early days of my detention, I was interrogated and physically tortured. I was beaten with an electric cable and threatened with a metal chair, the tire, and electric shocks. I was forced to falsely confess that I had been to Afghanistan. When I was not being beaten, I was put in a waiting room so that I could hear the screams of other victims. The cries of the women haunt me most. The United States has made no attempt to defend or justify what it did to Maha Arar. The then Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, acknowledged before Congress that his case had not been handled the way it should have been. But there has been no apology or no effort of compensation from the Bush administration or the Obama administration. Indeed, Maha Arar today remains on the U.S. no-fly list, and he's still excluded from setting foot on U.S. soil, despite the fact that the Canadian government held out a full inquiry, which exonerated him completely and awarded him $10 million Canadian dollars in damages.
Update, update, update. At the end of the protest, members of Witness Against Torture doubled back on the U.S. Capitol and disrupted a vote in the U.S. House of Representatives at about 4:40 p.m. Members of Witness Against Torture interrupted the proceedings, calling for closing Guantanamo Bay Prison and opposing provisions in a defense appropriations bill for detention policy. 15 people stood in the gallery and read this statement, quote, "Today, the House of Representatives is in the process of contemplating not the passage of a bill, but the commission of a crime. Provisions in the proposed Defense Appropriations Bill grant the United States powers over the lives of detained men, fitting of a totalitarian state that uses the law itself as an instrument of tyranny.
The law would make the prison at Guantanamo permanent by denying funds for the transfer of men to the United States, even for prosecution in civilian courts. Abandoning the civilian courts, the bill would be the ultimate concession that the rule of law and cherished American values cannot survive the fear and hatred that have consumed this country. The proposed bill makes restrictions on the transfers of detainees even to foreign countries so severe that no one, whether cleared for release by our own government or acquitted in trials, could be expected to leave Guantanamo. It therefore mandates the indefinite detention even of innocent human beings, which is the very essence of tyranny. Congress has the obligation to uphold the U.S. Constitution. All Americans have the obligation to defend human rights. The proposed bill makes America a callous and reckless jailer, unworthy of the name of democracy. It must be defeated. Guantanamo must close. Those unjustly bound must be freed. Justice must rule. After reading this statement, the heroic activists, with the courage to interrupt the House of Representatives, were arrested by presumably by the Capitol Police.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
On Wednesday, 28th of June, tear gas, fire and smoke filled the air as thousands of protesters took to the streets of Athens, Greece to say no to a budget-cutting austerity program demanded by the European Union, the Germans, and the IMF. Protesters set flaming barricades, rolled flaming dumpsters to the streets, and hammered police under a barrage of stones while the cops fired tear gas in the crowds. The police were only able to catch 18 people, and four cops wound up in the hospital with battle injuries. The fighting took place one day before the Greek parliament was scheduled to vote on the austerity package.
We can now cross live and join a financial journalist, Petros Papakonstantinou, who's a columnist at an Athens newspaper.
The pressure from the European Union is tremendous. We could talk about the blackmail against the Greek government, because they say that unless you vote for this outrageous bill tomorrow in Athens, there will be no more loans and Greece will be left to default. My personal opinion is that this is a bluff from European Union, because if Greece goes default, then we'll have a domino effect against the euro that will be a disaster for European Union at large. But unfortunately, our government has not the nerve to call them bluff. And this is the difficult part of the story.
In a recent article, you wrote that within 5 years, Greece will have paid out more than the total bailout in interest and fees. Is an economic recovery even possible under that burden?
Exactly. In 5 years' time, Greece has to pay just for interest, not for the refinance of the original loans, just for interest, about 130 billion euros. While the loan for the alleged bailout of Greece was only 110 billion euros. These interest payments will be more than the sum of what we pay for education, for health and for social insurance. Many analysts like Marco Weisbrot in The Guardian and New York Times have said that these conditions imposed to the Greek people are a sort of collective punishment like the one that the German Republic of Weimar had to go through after the disaster in the Long War. So the Greek people cannot tolerate.
You're damn right they won't, and they aren't. On Wednesday, the 29th of June, the entire Greek parliament had to fight their way through rioters before they could even take a vote.
Well, they'd be fighting on the streets of Athens now for the past hour or so. The vote is about to take place, but the smell of tear gas is really quite overpowering.
Needless to say, just like members of Congress in this country would, they sold out their country to the banksters.
Total 298 deputies voted. 155 deputies voted yes.
Όχι, ψήφισαν 138 βουλευτές.
138 deputies voted no and 5 deputies abstained. Thus, the bill with the mid-term plan for 2012 to 2015 has been approved by the majority.
Καταρχήν κατάρθρουν και στο σύνολο κατά πλειοψηφία.
And so the all-important Greek austerity package has been passed.
There's just one problem. The Greek people won't cooperate. A key part of the austerity package is taxes on minimum wage earners and other low-income people, but many in Greece say they will quit their jobs as it will no longer pay enough to justify their time. This will make revenue go down and expenses go up, opposite the plan's intention. As this is being debated, unions throughout Greece are on strike. A mass walkout, meaning a general strike, has been announced beginning later this week. And general strikes close factories and shops, again causing tax revenue to plummet. With opposition like this, the IMF advised austerity program passes the final vote tomorrow. The Greek government should expect more strikes, tax evasion, workplace occupations, forcible resistance to eviction from public housing, the whole works. The street riots might be just the beginning of something that ends either in the Greek government repudiating their debt or else in a complete collapse of the Greek government's authority over anyone. Hey, Tea Party, GOP, Governor of Wisconsin, want general strikes and riots here? Just keep pushing those budget repair bills. On the Xingu River in Brazil, authorities are once again trying to build a hydroelectric dam, now called Belo Monte. This dam was formerly known as Cararo, but that turned out to be the word for war in the language of an indigenous tribe opposing the dam, a tribe who threatened exactly that. The project has been stopped since 1975 by controversies over indigenous rights and forced displacement, but a license to begin construction was issued on the 1st of June this year. On the 20th of June, members of Amazon Watch and other supporters of indigenous rights in Brazil turned up outside the Brazilian embassy in Georgetown, much to the displeasure of corporate tenants of that same building.
As you may have noticed, folks who own this building are trying to harass us and prevent us from being here because they don't like being embarrassed, they don't like a ruckus outside their building, and, you know, we're not trying to get arrested, but I think that if you're a business owner and you're renting to an institution that is carrying out the destruction of indigenous people's land, you should expect protest. That's the
problem. Yeah.
There are those who say that the whole reason the Europeans ever came to the Americas was because they destroyed their own rivers, the population of fish crashed, and the fishermen of Europe had to go farther and farther out to sea to find fish. Now they want to destroy the rivers of the Americas. Last year, Bank of America got over $4 billion in tax breaks. If you bought a soda at CVS, you probably paid more in taxes than Bank of America did last year. On the 21st of June, the National Alliance of HUD Tenants showed up in front of Bank of America, demanding that Bank of America pay their taxes and that GOP proposals to balance the budget on the backs of the poor be abandoned.
The National Alliance of HUD Tenants is in town. Many of them came from Boston, Massachusetts, down here to D.C., and it's because their organization is fighting against the cuts to HUD. The federal government is talking about cutting $5.7 billion to HUD in fiscal year 2012 because of the Paul Ryan budget, because we all know that we now have a two-party Congress.
And here are the ugly facts. In 2009, Bank of America had an income of $4.4 billion after receiving a $45 billion bailout from taxpayers. In 2009, Bank of America didn't pay a penny in taxes. In the Paul Ryan budget bill is included $4.2 billion in tax breaks for the wealthy overall. This tax break is effectively paid for, as the Republicans demand, by that $5.7 billion budget cut for HUD. That budget cut for HUD means cuts in Section 8 and cuts in public housing. And meanwhile, while the rich get a tax break financed by throwing tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of people out on the street, Bank of America alone reports assets of an excess of $2 trillion, enough to pay for all the bailouts on Earth.
If they don't pay their taxes, and the people in Washington, D.C., and Washington, in the Senate and the House, cut the budget, then 600,000 people are going to be put into the street and will have nowhere to live.
Everyone that's standing on these streets, if you paid $1 in taxes this year, you paid more than the Bank of America.
There are those who say you can't fight City Hall. There are those who say protesting is a waste of time. In DC, however, they've just been proven wrong. When DC Council Chairman Kwame Brown proposed to close all homeless shelters to avoid raising taxes on the rich, about 200 protesters swarmed the Wilson Building. When they went to Kwame Brown's office, some warned that if homeless people were turned out of shelters, riots would be next.
There were tent cities, and that's what this city's gonna turn into if we don't save these benefits and shelters for people to live in. Now, also, after Dr. King's death, there were riots, or at least a riot, a terrible riot that affected a large part of the city. That can also happen. So you either go to jail now, or you go to jail next year.
They got that about the riots. As a result, Kwame Brown threw in the towel, and the shelters will stay open. He still chose to nickel and dime the middle class with fees instead of taxing the rich. But remember, it wasn't the middle class saying they would riot, and it wasn't the middle class looking at sleeping outdoors every night except during hypothermia season. Protest works. You can fight City Hall. Don't just vote. Organize. Get together with your neighbors and those you know the most. Stand up to Walmart. Stand up to City Hall.
The city, this is movement music.
Have you heard the news?
Walmart's coming Georgia Avenue, uptown. Ain't that something? Something. Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping. Cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping. Something. See, you can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave labors. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market. Hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to unionize, soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than their male equivalent. On these issues and more, we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart.
It's not a good fit for Chocolate City. Let me holla black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember DC doesn't work with the right wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister. Strom Thurmond, similar. Confederate, state loving George Bush ministers. Oversee your plantation mentality. Results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The DC Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs, and now they wanna come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts. Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep DC Walmart green. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunist out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
Keep DC Walmart free is an emerging activist group of DC residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in DC by 2012. Walmarts in DC will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.
This summer, the U.S. Park Police have launched a blitzkrieg of harassment, tickets, and wrongful arrests aimed at making sure that no pedicab or bicycle rickshaw driver will dare to hang out, pick up passengers, or discharge passengers on a national mall. Channel 9 News broadcast this phone call where a pedicab operator asking for clarification of the rules was responded to with threats and obscenity from a park police sergeant.
I think just having a better idea of what to expect and what to do to avoid any sort of prosecution will go a long way to alleviating a lot of the stress that's been felt amongst drivers, and I really appreciate you taking the time to help with that. Thank you.
In case you couldn't hear that, the pedicab driver said this, quote, "I think just having a better idea of what to expect and what to do to avoid prosecution will go a long way to alleviating a lot of the stress that's being felt among drivers, and I really appreciate you taking the time to help with that stuff." Here's the park police sergeant's response, including the words Channel 9 News didn't have the guts to leave in the audio but printed on screen. Quote, "If they call my officers assholes, it's going to come down on every single one of them out there, okay? Just to be given a heads up, say, look, you know, they may think asshole all they want, but as soon as they call the first one asshole, every pedicab driver out there is ultimately going to pay for that. You know what I'm saying? Okay, now that cop is a real asshole to respond to such a reasonable call from a pedicab operator with a stream of such obscenity and threats. Not only that, he needs his mouth washed out with a toilet brush, and he makes me want to wash my microphone out in toilet cleaner. Group punishment is being threatened here, which is illegal even in a declared war. Already there have been many ugly incidents, including a reporter from Channel 7 News being told falsely that he had to have a permit to shoot video in the mall. Let's not forget, this is strike 3 for the U.S. Park Police. At the Jefferson Memorial, some journalists were told they had to have permits. This after park police violently arrested people for dancing the previous week. Next, D.C.'s own radio journalist Pete Tucker and a videographer were both arrested for recording a meeting of the Taxi Cab Commission by U.S. Park Police, the meeting being held in a Park Police headquarters. Now the Park Police think they can do jihad by beating and arresting people for operating a taxi cab without a gasoline engine. What do we have in this city? The Park Police or the Park Gestapo? Okay, Park Police, since you like taking out your beefs on everyone if you have a beef with anyone, you made the rules now in force. If any member of the U.S. Park Police shall harass anyone for operating a pedicab, a bicycle, or any other human-powered vehicle on our public streets, don't be surprised if people take it out on each and every member of the United States Park Police. You ask for it, you got it. Have you had enough of paying $3 to $4 a gallon for gas? Have you had enough of sitting in traffic as your sweat and your radiator compete to see who can boil over first? There's an alternative to getting caught in downtown traffic. In the first Friday of every month, bicycle riders gather in DuPont Circle at 6 p.m. for critical mass. I repeat, bicycle riders will gather on Friday, the 1st of July at 6 p.m. in DuPont Circle and take you to the streets at about 6:30 p.m. for critical mass. Critical mass is about bicycle riders exercising our rights to ride in the streets of D.C. The streets are open to all vehicles, not just cars. Bicycles have the same right to ride on the street as everybody else. And critical mass, first Friday of every month, 6 p.m. at DuPont Circle, is a celebration of this. Get your bike out of the closet. Come on out and ride. Meet 6 p.m. DuPont Circle. Depart 6:30 p.m. for critical mass on Friday, the 1st of July. On the 24th of June, protesters showed up at Spanish embassies all over the world demanding the immediate and unconditional release of 12 legal and peaceful animal rights activists arrested on trumped-up eco-terrorism charges. One of the protests was at the Spanish embassy in Washington, D.C. Here in D.C., activists from the Equal Justice Alliance and Farm Animal Reform Movement were able to enter the Spanish embassy and deliver a letter for the ambassador.
And this is Will Potter with Greens and Blue Red and Jen Riley, also with Equal Justice Alliance. We have a letter here from the Equal Justice Alliance about the 12 activists in Spain who were recently arrested for their legal and protected animal rights activities. This letter we'd like to be delivered to your. Yeah, we'd like it to be known in Spain itself that this letter is given.
And outside the embassy, it was a very noisy and showy protest.
Today is a day of solidarity with 12 Spanish activists who were arrested in Spain for their legal animal rights activities. We are picketing the Embassy of Spain today as part of these worldwide protests because these Spanish authorities have charged these activists as eco-terrorists. We request that Spain drop the eco-terrorist charges, release the activists, and provide them with vegan meals for the maintaining time, duration of the time they are in custody. These activists, members of Igualdad Animal and Equa Animal, non-violent animal advocacy organizations, document animal welfare violations. We are aware that these arrests represent wanton repression of Spanish animal advocacy instigated by the fur industry, who is already guilty of animal welfare violations. We feel that charging animal activists with terrorism insults the memory of the 190 Spanish victims of the worst real act of terrorism on Europe in Spain, March 2004.
In Spanish embassy, animal abusers, don't think that when protesters leave your office that it's over. On the evening of Saturday, 25th of July, animal rights protesters showed up at the home of the ambassador of Spain. They were protesting the July 22nd arrest of 12 legal above-ground activists on trumped-up so-called eco-terrorism charges.
Mr. Ambassador, activism is not a crime!
Spanish 12 should not be gone!
Mr. Ambassador, activism is not a crime!
Spanish 12 should not be
gone! Mr. Ambassador, once again we are here! Because on June 22nd, 12 activists were arrested for doing nothing more than above ground
sabe que são inocentes, pessoas que não fazem nada, não fazem nada contra ninguém, somente para que tentem defender os animais. Sabe que são inocentes, mas tu continua com eles na cadeia. Tu pode levar eles, ou tu pode também esperar uma campanha grande que vai continuar até eles são liberados. Até aquele dia, tu pode esperar nos volver muitas vezes, porque nós nunca desistimos quando os animais são abusados e quando as pessoas que nos defendem também são abusados. One, two, three, four.
Open up the cage door.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Special box and liberty.
You heard that? Liberate the prisoners, both the Spanish 12 and the prisoners in the fur farms on whose behalf they were arrested.
Almost all of the nation's state legislatures this year were forced to focus on large budget deficits and figuring out ways to deal with them, including deep cuts to government services and programs. But just like in the U.S. House of Representatives, many legislatures controlled by Republicans made time to debate bills that restrict women's access to abortion. Hundreds of measures were introduced around the country, and a significant number were passed. Some require mandatory ultrasounds. Others ban abortions after 20 weeks with no exceptions for the health of the mother or rape or incest. Others still place restrictions on abortion coverage in the federal government's new health insurance exchanges. Four states have banned abortion after 20 weeks of pregnancy, joining Nebraska, which did the same before the 2010 election. Some states have attempted to impose a legislative ban on all funding to groups such as Planned Parenthood that offer preventive care like pap smears and birth control, in addition to abortion services. Indiana's law prohibiting funds to Planned Parenthood is now facing a court challenge. The groups and politicians supporting these dozens of state anti-abortion bills are openly attempting to coordinate their efforts to chip away at the Supreme Court's 1973 decision on Roe v. Wade that made abortion legal in the United States. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Nancy Keenan, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America. She talks about these recently passed state restrictions on reproductive rights and how her organization is responding.
The anti-choice agenda at the state level has just been more than we have seen in the past, particularly more than last year. It's amazing that we had, I believe, somewhere around 456 anti-choice bills introduced compared to about half that last year. And, you know, you take a look again about the composition of the state legislatures. We have 15 states now with an anti-choice governor, and both houses of the legislature in the hands of anti-choice politicians.
Is that the same as Republicans?
You know, we're a nonpartisan group. Our party is choice. But yeah, but sadly so, we're seeing that there are very few pro-choice Republicans running anymore in that party. It has very much changed from the day where they believed in personal privacy and liberty, and they've gone much more to the right.
Of all those hundreds of bills that were introduced, please just talk about some that were passed in which states and what they actually do.
Yeah. Let me talk about the mandatory, very clear about this, mandatory ultrasound bill. That was introduced in 28 bills in about 14 states. Two of those have passed in two states, in Arizona and Texas. And as you know, that bill primarily interferes with the doctor-patient relationship. And, you know, we believe that women should have the option of an ultrasound if they request it or if their doctor recommends it, but it should not be forced on them. And here again, we are seeing these anti-choice politicians putting their agenda in the examination room with the doctor and the patient. It's a matter of if a woman determines that she is considering termination of the pregnancy, this requires women to have a mandatory ultrasound for the doctor to show her the results, oftentimes to read a script about it. Let me just talk a little bit about the Nebraska-like bans that we've seen in the states as well. This is a place where we have seen in 30 bills, there's been about 30 bills in 14 states, 5 bills have been enacted in 5 states. So we've seen it in Alabama, Idaho, Indiana, Kansas, Oklahoma. And then in Minnesota, I believe that one was vetoed. This means that it is a ban. There will be no abortions after 20 weeks, and there are no exceptions for the women's health, rape, or incest. And it's very much modeled after Nebraska that was enacted in 2010. It obviously interferes in the doctor-patient relationship. This is a ban that harms women who have wanted pregnancies that may experience some heartbreaking complications such as a fetal anomaly or a cancer diagnosis. This ban could threaten a woman's health, her ability to have children in the future if she can't access this care. And so this is their strategy, again.
I don't want to leave anything out. Are there any other anti-choice measures that were put into effect this year in different states?
The health care bill that was passed at the federal level, which then requires states to put these insurance exchanges in place. We've seen as those states begin to implement those insurance exchanges, there are statewide bans on abortion. So presently, we have seen 7 states basically take away insurance coverage of abortion, deny insurance companies to cover abortion if they want to participate in the exchange in that state. They're basically saying, if you want to do business in our state and you're an insurance company that covers abortion care, of which 87% of insurance companies presently do, if you want to do business in our state, you have to basically not cover abortion care. So it interferes with the woman's ability to make those private decisions. Obviously, it discriminates against women who work for small business owners or pay for their insurance with their private money.
So, Nancy Keenan, this is a pretty depressing scenario. How is NARAL Pro-Choice America dealing with this new reality?
Well, look, you know, number one, elections matter. As we head into the 2012 elections, we know that we have to establish the contrast between these people that ran on jobs in the economy and are spending all of their time attacking reproductive health care. We have had about an average of 1,000 new names to our email list every day. So people are paying attention and they understand the consequences of the folks that were elected last year. We've had about 500,000 messages to Congress because, again, it's not only the state attacks, it's the federal attacks. So we have been making our voices heard in Congress. And like I said, we're building now for 2012, build the contrast between pro-choice candidates and the lawmakers who are advancing this extreme agenda.
That was Nancy Keenan of NARAL Pro-Choice America. Find more information about various states' anti-abortion legislation and pro-choice groups' response on our website at btlonline.org.